Okay. Thanks so much for tuning in. You're listening to WDRT Community Radio. I'm Christina DeRocher, and we're here with Paul Rattay, the skeptical naturopath. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Christina. How are you?
Fabulous. How are you?
Just right below or right above that? Maybe better than fabulous? I don't know.
Then I'm jealous.
Yes.
So today we're going to talk about popular diets. Woof.
Yeah, you got to add the woof.
What's the connection to woof?
Dog. Woof. Isn't there some meme or something with woof?
Like, I don't know.
Oh,
I
yeah. That it's just, what do I mean by woof? Like, good luck.
Uh-huh.
Good luck. Like, forget about it. I'm not sure.
As the Norskies would say, oofta.
Kind of oofta. Yeah. Woof.
Okay.
Run. Quick. Away.
Yes. Yeah. Too much. Too much to handle. So where shall we begin?
So we did end the last episode. I think the intent was to talk about popular diets last time, too.
It was. And you have your list.
I have my list, right? I ended with my list. So I've done popular diets. You've done, I don't know, have you done popular diets? I don't know. Macrobiotic, does it count as a popular diet?
I think it does from the 70s.
Yeah.
In the 70s, it was somewhat popular. It was called the brown rice diet or the cancer diet. I mean, there were a few angles by which you could approach it that made it pretty, I wouldn't say mainstream, but it was popular in its day. I mean, in New York, there are still macrobiotic restaurants.
I mean, there's still macrobiotic books being published.
That's true.
So that means there's still a market for it. So, I mean, they're going to rehash every single diet over and over and over and over if there's a market for it.
True. True. That's what I've noticed about the macrobiotic books, actually, is, you know, I started when I was 19, so that was about 26 years ago. And, you know, the new books that come out, they look very familiar. In fact, some are released under the same name, New Edition. But, you know, I always thought I would be studying it until my dying day. But you do realize that at a certain point, you can grasp quite a bit. And
do you reach the end?
I wouldn't, that's pretty arrogant of me to say, I would say, you know, I mean, there's still, I guess what I mean is there's always a way to bring it more into practice. Maybe you understand it all, but you haven't applied all of it.
Yeah, the clinical application versus sort of, this is what you're supposed to do. Here are the rules. Here's the laws. You can't eat this. You can eat this. And then, but maybe I can. Can I cheat a little bit? Is that like, is somebody going to watch over me and spy on me? Do I know that? So as a side note, of course, I'll digress. So I use my Fitness Pal. Are you familiar with my Fitness Pal?
Yes.
So I have patients use that. I have students use that too. So students do a popular diet, or they do a popular diet, but in an earlier term, they do a diet analysis. So that's how they can track their diet for a week. And it's free, right? You can go online and track things.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. So I have patients use that too, partly because it's free. We can also become friends on there. So then I can look at their diet.
Oh, that's helpful.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of my follow-up is done by phone with patients. So this way, if they friend me, I can pull that up and see what's going on. So I've been on MyFitnessPal for a long time. And it's very interesting on how many patients actually use MyFitnessPal. Or will use MyFitnessPal. Because if they want advice on how to eat, right? So they come to me and say, oh, Paul, what should I eat? Do you know what I'm going to say when? Did we talk about this?
Well, what do you want? What are you looking for?
What do you want? Yeah, well, that's important. But what else? What are you doing right now?
Oh,
like,
right,
what are you
right.
eating now? And how do we know it's good or bad? Or what fad are you following? What popular diet are you following? Or kind of what's your philosophy? But I kind of need that context, yeah? What you're eating.
Right.
Give me a diet diary. Like, write it down for 3 days. Or keep MyFitnessPal, and it'll track things. And MyFitnessPal will track your carbs and your fat and your calories, which may be important somewhat. But I'm more interested in how people feel.
Right.
So they can keep track of that, right? So they can use it as a diet diary as well. So there's food notes in there, and they type in the little notes and say, oh, you know, I had a headache today, right? Mm-hmm. So if somebody has a headache, I ask them, well, do you have a headache every day? Is it once a month? Is it 3 times a month? Is it, and when does it happen? What's the pattern? So that's where, I mean, I want to rule out it's not a food related to it, right? Because if it's a food, then take the food out and things get better. And
doctor, it hurts when I do this. Don't do that.
Exactly. So I use MyFitnessPal. I can go on MyFitnessPal. I can go on right now. I can see patients. I can see students, I can see people that have kept that. And some people have continued to maintain MyFitnessPal for like 8 years.
Oh, wow.
They continue to use that tool. But anyways, I guess my point here is that I can look at that and kind of see what they're doing, right? It's interesting. And just get a framework on how long do they follow something. And again, I mean, it's kind of exhaustive if you're going to look through, you know, a year worth of diet right. diaries. But if I'm with a patient, I can do that for the last month and I can kind of scroll through that and see. And then I'm always looking at food notes. And really, I mean, it may be a useful tool for a while, but I mean, is our job to be tracking exactly how many calories we eat?
I would hope not.
Yeah.
Some considering people do I've that, actually never done it myself.
It keeps them, I mean, that's the way they think. That's the accountant perspective, right?
Right.
That's why I love accountants in practice, because they keep good data.
Right.
Artists don't.
True.
I mean, if we're looking for hard data, right, or objective data, or we're write down what you eat, write down how you feel.
Right. But it seems to me like it's a preliminary useful tool, and that if you continue to be so scientific about it, you may not, you know, it may not be enjoyable after a while because it's so cerebral.
So are we looking for science to tell us the answer to what our diet is?
Right.
So, oh, tell me what to eat. Tell me what the research tells me, and that's what I'll eat. Are you kidding me? Like, do other people eat this way? Did my ancestors eat this way? You know, where has this come from? And we talked about Mediterranean diet last week or last month. You know, so what is it that you're going to kind of cling to? Or what is it that you're going to follow and say, I'm willing to sacrifice all these things that I've done before because now I'm going to follow the straight and narrow.
Okay.
And popular diets do that. And popular diets are providing you the framework. They'll absolutely think for you.
Right, yes.
Right? I mean, follow a ketogenic diet. You get the black and white list. You get the, here's what you can eat, here's what you can't eat. Very simple, straightforward.
Recipes, meal plans, here's what you eat on day one, here's how to use the leftovers. I mean, some of them are very, very
exactly.
accurate in
and
that way.
And then we have the, oh, here, the one I like, right? This is the one. The Wholesome, Yum, Easy Keto Cookbook. Are you kidding me? Oh, my goodness. There's a book. That's what it's named.
Wholesome,
the
Yum.
The Wholesome, Yum, Easy Keto Cookbook.
That's everything you want. Nutritious, delicious, and wholesome, yum. What was the third one?
Wholesome, yum, easy,
easy,
of course.
Right, right, of course.
And then keto, that just defines it so you know you're not going to eat a carb.
Right.
So, I mean, you can make desserts that are keto, but what does that mean? Can I use fake sugar? Like, can I use stevia and can I use monk fruit? And then that's okay because it's not a carbohydrate. So it's very interesting how you try to make that work for you. You're like, oh, I don't eat any sugar, but I eat all these
extremely processed
sweetened things that aren't sweetened with sugar. And yes, maybe the metabolic effect is not there, but does that really change your palate? And why are you driven to eat sweet foods? Or you know what I mean? Maybe we want to work on lowering your bliss point. So maybe you don't need as much sugar. Because honestly, I don't like stevia. I don't like monk fruit. I don't like erythritol. Those are all the alternative
sweeteners. Because they're processed?
No, because they don't taste good.
Okay. See, I'm more academic about it. I don't like the fact that it came from something from nature, but then it's not even recognizable on the other end.
Stevia is pretty close, though. So stevia is a plant.
Yeah.
You can just use that. Now, Coke and Pepsi and Cargill have their derivatives of that, the stevia glycosides that they've patented.
Okay.
But you can just buy regular old stevia, which is basically an herb.
Okay.
It's not processed.
Okay.
Or, you know, processed as much as any other herb is.
Right.
But I don't like the taste of it.
Yeah.
I like the taste of sugar.
Which, well, yeah, I don't actually use sugar. I do honey and maple syrup and rice syrup myself.
Correct. But what I mean is like actually a real sweetener. And again, we could say honey is going to change depending on what batch of honey it was, what the bees were feeding on, what pollen they had. Yes.
Right,
I mean,
true.
It's going to change.
True.
Maple syrup will change, right? How much did they process
boil it,
down. Right? How much did they boil it down? How much did they do this? Maple water is much different than maple syrup, and they've got to convert that. But still, there's some sweetness to that. And I'm gonna say that's a more natural sweetness, let's call it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whether it's sucrose, so sucrose being cane sugar or beet sugar, you can't really tell the difference between those because biochemically it's, you know, one molecule of glucose, one molecule of fructose put together, and it doesn't matter what the source is. And it's been refined. Right? Mm-hmm. But you can buy, you know, sugar cane that's not fully refined. What do they call it? It's like the dark sugar.
Right.
They, you know, used to use it to make rum, and then they would process it more. But anyway, so if you want to look at that and say, oh, well, that's a more natural sugar. Natural just meaning it's less refined.
True.
Mm-hmm. Right. And again, honey and maple syrup would be perhaps less refined. But I would still say I like the taste of those things. I don't like the taste of stevia. Stevia tastes, I don't know if it's fake. I don't know. I don't like it. Yeah. Erythritol is that sugar alcohol. And you eat too much sugar alcohol and you get some digestive issues.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Some would say anal leakage. Now, that's a interesting word. Interesting, like you're not highly motivated to have anal leakage,
no.
Which basically just means diarrhea.
Right, right. They used to have that in potato chips, Oleo.
Yes.
That was the other
Orlistat.
One. Orlistat. Oh, my.
Ah, yes. That's a problem. But too many sugar alcohols will do that same thing.
Interesting.
Yes.
Did not know that.
So, but regardless, it's just a taste thing.
Okay. Right?
So I don't like the taste of those fake things. So you follow some kind of diet and you're like, oh, I'm keto, but I eat all this kind of fake sweetened kind of things. And does that really help your bliss point? Because you're still looking for sweet. You're just not able to get the real sweet. You can't get any carbs with it. So I've got to make these other choices versus, wow, I don't need any carbohydrates because I don't have any carbohydrates available to me. Or I don't need any meat because I don't have any meat available to me based on kind of my hunter-gatherer existence. Right? Did we talk about the Hadza and how much honey they eat? I don't know if we talked about that before.
I don't know. You and I have talked about it.
Yeah, we've talked about it. So the Hadza, for example, they eat, you know, 15% of their calories as sugar, as honey.
As honey, right, right.
But they don't eat it all one time. Or they do eat it all one time. They don't average it. So we look at it and, oh, well, average over the years, 15% of your calories. No, when they find honey, they binge eat honey.
They eat as much as probably is available at that time, knowing that they may not know when they'll find it again.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes. So you're out in the wild, you find a wild blueberries. What are you going to do? Like, take them home? Maybe. But the whole idea is, well, I'm going to eat them because the only place I can store them is in my stomach. So right. I'll store as much as I can in my stomach and then I'll go on my way, right?
Right. And Mother Nature, you can trust Mother Nature because she's not giving you blueberries all year round. So you're never going to really, I mean, maybe in a day you would gorge yourself if you found a huge blueberry patch. But
yes.
They only blossom and bloom, you know, and fruit at certain times. And so you can trust Mother Nature.
Correct, but we fool her, yes?
Oh, my
gosh. So I can eat strawberries and blueberries in February, in January. I can eat a banana every single day. And bananas are actually pretty inexpensive.
They're very inexpensive.
Yes.
Yes.
So
and
they're
readily available.
Readily available, easy.
Always ripe.
Sweet.
I mean,
right? A checkbox, check, 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 check. But nobody here ate bananas 100 years ago. We don't have them.
But, nobody? We didn't have...
How do you eat a banana in Wisconsin?
Oh, right. No, not here. But they ate them in the tropics.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I understand
what you mean. They don't have the transportation to get them to places where...
Correct.
Yes.
So we're relying upon petroleum to do this.
Unless you're macrobiotic. There is a dictum in macrobiotics. It's the 500-mile law or something like that. You know, basically anything within a 500-mile radius.
Yeah, so where did that dictum come from?
The same idea that you're... Well... Macrobiotics talks about it in a spiritual way, and they talk about the chi or the vibe of your area in its season, and you want to resonate with your area. In other words, you may actually get to what you know, macrobiotics works with yin and yang or acid and alkaline. Mm-hmm. Scientists would know this as. And so you would become perhaps too dispersive, too yin, even in the summertime if you're eating too many tropical fruits because, for instance, in Wisconsin, today is a great example. Today is actually tropical, but, you know, we don't have that consistently. So, for instance, if you're eating a banana in the wintertime, you are getting into this expansive energy, you know, my energy is a tricky word too.
Sure.
But at any rate, you want to eat something that resonates with your area. And the best way to do that is to eat exactly what's growing and what's available in your area or within 500 mile radius.
Right. And there's wisdom to that.
Mm-hmm.
But who determines 500 miles? Is it 500 miles? Is it 5 miles?
It's a really good point. I think it really has to do with the fact that biomes change, right? I mean, I'd actually have to look at a map, to be honest, to see what a real 500-mile radius from Viroqua is on all sides. But I think the idea is it's not going to be the desert even. It's not even going to be Arizona. It's not even going to be Florida, right? And so you're in the Midwest and you're eating Midwest foods. And then people would say, well, so you're going against macrobiotics if you buy broccoli in the winter, even broccoli, because it's not technically growing in the winter.
That's right.
So there again, you're making concessions. It's the same thing with salt and seaweed and spices. Because we're landlocked here for the most part. I mean, obviously we have the Mississippi, but you know, we're not cultivating our own salt, and certainly we're not near an ocean where seaweed is growing either. So, you know, yeah,
right. And
concessions.
So an offshoot of that, somewhat related, is iodine deficiency in the Great Lakes region. So goiters were very common 100, 200 years ago.
Yes.
Because iodine, the soil in the Great Lakes area is poor in iodine. So we're not getting iodine from our soil. So we're not getting iodines from the animals that live here and eat the plants. We're not getting it from the plants that grow here.
Okay. So, or even the fish that are swimming in the waters.
Because not so much in the fresh water as much as we get from the salt water.
Right.
So in other words, iodine deficiency was very common. And that's just what's provided in your environment.
And so what did people do?
Interesting. They get goiters. So the idea is what eventually we did is we iodized salt. So now we figured out that this is an iodine deficiency, and now we have to supplement that.
Oh, I see. Right?
And again, so I want to be careful that it's not just you're fixing something and you're like, oh, I have the answer, and here, take B vitamins, and here, take iodine, and here, put fluoride in the water to prevent cavities, right? All these things. But that's a public health perspective, right? So public health means that we need to deal with this instead of how would we have dealt with that originally 200 years ago? Did Native Americans have goiter? I don't know. I'm just asking this question because that's what I'm thinking about now. Were they dealing with goiters, or were they eating some food source that was native here that they've got iodine from?
Right.
And iodine's not, I mean, there's some in fish, but not so much in freshwater fish. Tea has it. But again, it's going to concentrate whatever's in the environment.
Right. In other words, if it's not in the environment, eating things of the earth, you know, or of the waters in this case, is not going to bring that into existence. That's really interesting.
Yes.
I would be very interested to find out what the Native Americans did, because I tend not to trust iodized salt.
Yeah,
right?
Correct.
I've never used it in my macrobiotic practice, at least. I always buy the sea salt.
Yeah. And no iodine in the sea salt.
Right. Right.
But then you eat those little, the seaweed squares, you know, nori. So that's going to have iodine. It's going to have a broad spectrum of minerals in it. Comes from the ocean.
Right.
Right. You dry it. It's pretty straightforward. Kind of tasty, too. Right.
But
that's just a source of minerals. Right. So multiple minerals there. I mean, pellagra is another example of that. So pellagra is niacin deficiency, which is rampant in the United States in the late 1800s. Civil War time and even after. And it's interesting that niacin, part of it is we find it in a variety of foods, but specifically in corn. So corn is a source of niacin. And so the native cultures they do what they call nixtamalize. So nixtamalize means when they're grinding or they soak the corn, they have to add like lye to it, something alkaline to that.
Right.
And
they soak it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And what that does is it releases the niacin. So now the niacin is available, bioavailable, so we can absorb it. If you don't do that, you don't get any niacin from. The niacin is in a fixed form that you can't utilize. So even though you eat it, it's a problem. Now, corn was native, right? Native to South America and up into Mexico as well. And so that kind of takes off, right? Because we can grow corn. In the southern United States, I mean, corn was a staple there.
Right.
And we saw a lot of pellagra. And a lot of that has to do with, we didn't actually
process it the way
we didn't process it the natives did. So we learned from the natives, like, oh, they make cornmeal or whatever they use cornmeal for, right? We came over and we discover this, right? Where we see what they're doing and we mimic that, but they forgot the soaking step.
Or knowing Americans, they skipped it.
Yeah, they skipped it, right? Oh, that takes too much time, but yet there's some wisdom in that. And perhaps the wisdom is that the natives that knew that So they knew if we did that, we don't see these things. Or I don't know, like, what's the origin of that?
Again, that's a fascinating thread, I'm sure, to follow as well, how they first came across doing that, because that doesn't seem like it's second nature.
Yeah, and Weston Price, he was the dentist that visited in the 1920s all over the world to try to figure out why do we get cavities and why do we get dental crowding and other cultures don't get that. So he went to native cultures. And in the 20s, there were still a fair amount of people that were still relatively untouched by modern civilization. And he went and studied them. And his take home was that fat-soluble vitamins are really important, A, D, E, and K, especially vitamin K and vitamin A. And, well, vitamin D too, but K was something that wasn't even invented when he was doing his work. They talked about the activator enzyme, right? The activator, and actually turned out that it was vitamin K. So he didn't discover it, but he said there's some kind of thing that's here that's useful. But you see that cultures, you know, like the French trappers that were up in northern Canada, and they would die of scurvy. Right, so scurvy was an issue, and scurvy is because if you don't have, you know what, you get vitamins.
Vitamin C. Mm-hmm.
Vitamin C is from citrus fruits.
Right.
And how much citrus fruit are you getting in northern Canada? And how did they not get scurvy? How did the natives not get scurvy in northern Canada?
I don't know.
If they have access to the ocean, then that doesn't become a problem. It's when they're more landlocked that this becomes more of an issue.
Because they're eating fish and seaweed and things like that?
Yeah. Well, let's say they're landlocked, so they don't have access to fish. Mm-hmm. So Weston Price, I mean, he studied them, and he asked the question. I mean, maybe I don't have the story exactly right, but he went and he said, why don't you get scurvy? Mm-hmm. And they, like, had to ask the elder if it was okay to tell him or what, I guess. I mean, maybe I'm exaggerating this a little bit, but this is what I remember. So they took him out, and when they, you know, butcher an animal, they actually kept the adrenal gland, they harvested the adrenal gland and the tissue behind the eyes. And they would cut a piece of adrenal gland, so everybody in the tribe would get a little piece of adrenal gland, mm-hmm. like right then and there, mm-hmm. when they butcher the animal. And guess what the adrenal gland is high in?
That vitamin C.
Vitamin C. The tissue behind the eyes as well
are
vitamin C. So that's the idea that, yes, you eat meat, will you develop scurvy, but you're only eating muscle meat.
Right.
And again, I think that we got it all wrong, right? We're not eating the organ meats. We're not using the feet. We're not using the head. I mean, if we're butchering an animal in the wild, we're going to use every single part.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's perhaps that's, I don't know, more reverent, but I mean, I guess reverence.
Well, again, in macrobiotics, you don't peel the potato, you don't peel the carrot, you use the whole food. And so even in macrobiotics, you would eat the whole animal. You know, you would have to, I mean, right, it's a lost art for many at this point.
Yeah, we just use the parts that we want and we throw the rest away.
Well, and I would venture to say too, not just the ones we want, but the ones we're used to eating.
Yeah, correct.
We know about liver and we know about tongue and we don't want to
engage
with that.
Ooh, ew, taboo.
Right. And yet when you go to these native tribes, they're not squeamish at all.
No.
No,
and it's about
practical.
We're looking for calories. Mm-hmm. Are there calories somewhere instead of we have excess?
And for the variety, right? I mean, they're not just doing it to fulfill their dietary needs as far as being full, but they have that innate wisdom that says there's something in this, there's something in all of this that I need.
And perhaps what is that wisdom? Is it scientific wisdom, right? So scientific means that we've reduced it. We're able to determine that it is pellagra and it's related to niacin. It is scurvy. We have a disease and it's associated with vitamin C or ascorbic acid, right? Those are things that we can determine in a lab setting. Mm-hmm. We figure these things out and that's useful. But understand that there was some wisdom there to already deal with that.
Huge wisdom. And they would probably say, we don't need to pick it apart. We don't need to put it under a microscope to figure this out. We have a relationship with the land. We have a relationship with the animals. We have a relationship with our own understanding of our physiognomy, I would say, that precludes science.
For sure. And at the very least, it's how do you feel? How do you eat? What are you eating? And how do you feel? Like, right. Not what is your blood level, not what is your cholesterol, not what is your blood pressure. I mean, again, I don't want to ignore those things, but I got to look at the whole context.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I just had a conversation with a patient about, you know, what's the difference of, you know, he's 77 and he feels really good. And we just kind of check in every, you know, 6 to 9 months, and I run some basic labs on him and we just check out. Right. And the idea is, so I have some objective markers, yes? And I like objective markers, but I'm not going to run to them and say this is it. But we just watch that. And having an objective marker, you know, once a year over 10 years, it's kind of useful because you can see trends and is it moving in a certain direction. But he has a conversation, but I feel good. You know, I feel really good. I feel like I'm 50. I'm like, that's great. But how do we know that? Like, how do we judge that? Like, how does somebody, like, give you the clean bill of health? Like, what does it mean to feel good? What does it mean to accomplish all your activities of daily living? So he doesn't have a disease, but he still feels really good. Because honestly, in this case, he's somewhat anemic. And I think that there's a genetic component to that. But he just always runs that way, right? So that's always been that way his entire life. And so the idea is, yeah, but are you tired, right? So there's one thing about that, if somebody's tired and they come in and they're like, I can't get up in the morning, and we run a blood panel and we find, wow, you're anemic, right? Your hemoglobin, your hematocrit are really low. We got an issue here. Versus in this case, we're just doing that as a screening test. He doesn't have any quote unquote symptoms, but that's just something that pops up. That's just an abnormality for him his whole life. And I said, well, that's what we do. We're just kind of tracking that and making sure it doesn't like continue to slide on a downward trajectory, right? So that we've got some objective data, but at the end of the day, it's like, but I still feel really good. And, you know, I'm doing these things and, you know, we talk about diet and he could be better and that kind of thing. But I'm like, look, you're in a good place. He's yeah. like, yes, I could get hit by a truck tomorrow. I know what's going to happen. And I'm like, you're right. But how do you feel today? You're able to do the things, the activities of daily living that you want to accomplish.
Right. And isn't that the definition of, you know, being well, of being able to do the things you want to do? I actually just got back from a family reunion, and one of the matriarchs in the family, she's 80 something. And she said, you know, people would say, well, how are you? How are you? And she'd say, I'm still doing everything I want to do. I mean,
exactly.
What do you want? Right. So in your opinion, do you think we'll go back to having a more intuitive relationship to food? Do you think that's even possible in light of the popular diet scheme that we have?
Well, there are popular diets to get you more in tune with food, and don't the undiet diets, yes, and just pay attention to how you feel,
right?
And that kind of
right.
thing. Perhaps it's just that we still live in a culture of excess. We live in a culture where we're affluent. And we have access and we have convenience, and we don't spend the time cooking for ourselves, right? We allow somebody else to do something that I think is perhaps the most important thing, most important variable in my health is my diet, my opinion.
Right.
And I'm going to give that to somebody else.
Right.
And I'm going to trust them. And again, just trusting them, maybe, well, I didn't have time. Oh, well, that I go to this restaurant, it's better, right? It's better quality. But I still didn't look at the beginning to the end.
True.
And
amounts of things, even if the things are good, the amounts of things like salt and oil and sugar.
Exactly.
I mean, they're fine once in a while in even larger quantities, but my goodness, usually when you're eating out, it's really
And then you
excessive.
Can't change that, right?
Right, right.
So like sodium. So 80% of our sodium comes from what? 80% of the sodium in an average American diet, not your diet and not my diet, but 80% of the sodium comes from what?
Packaged food?
Packaged and restaurant food.
Okay.
And understand that sodium's not a bad guy. I don't think it's a bad guy.
We all need it.
We need it, but we use it because it preserves food.
Right.
Right. It also makes flavors pop, right? And plus it's part of this, like we have a bliss point for sugar, we have a bliss point for salt. And you can definitely alter your bliss point on salt. You eat a lot of salt, you continue to want more salt. Versus you can also downgrade that, right? Just like with sugar.
Mm-hmm.
But salt is really important as a preservative. And the food industry is really interested in having foods that have a shelf life of 10 years, not a shelf life of 2 months.
Right.
They put it on the shelf for 10 years. Great. I got 10 years to sell that product. And it tastes the same after 8 years. I'm exaggerating here, yes. But
Well, right. Or you could say it never really tasted that great to begin with, and it tastes the same after 8 years.
That's right.
So we'll pick this up after I tell you thank you for listening to WTRT. You're listening to Paul Rattay as the skeptical naturopath. So, yes, the canned food tastes like canned food. So it's lucky or wonderful that it tastes the same after 8 years, but I wouldn't say it was at its peak performance from the beginning.
Right. So sodium, and remind me, where were we at? Now I'm having a...
What was the thread here?
What was the thread?
One of the last questions I asked was, do you think we're going back to this intuitive way of eating amidst all of these popular diets? And what I got from you was, even the intuitive diets are becoming the popular diets within the pages of the modern cookbooks, you know. So
yeah, and how did salt come up? I'm sure it'll come back to me, because then I use salt as an example. I was trying to make an example of that.
Because you were talking about people who don't eat intuitively, and where does most of your
sodium where's the come salt
from?
Come from? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I'm paying attention.
So 80% of our salt is of sodium in the standard American diet, whoever's following the standard American diet, is coming from restaurant food and processed food. In other words, if you don't eat restaurant food and you don't eat processed food, you just cut your sodium by 80%.
That's an amazing number.
But I'll ask you, how much of your salt is coming from processed food and restaurant food compared to the salt shaker at home?
Well, luckily, it's very expensive to eat out.
Yes.
So the most I've ever eaten out is once a week.
Yes.
And even now, I mean, I went somewhere and I spent $50 on a couple of dishes and an appetizer. And I remember thinking, I'm not going to eat out even once a week going forward right now with inflation the way it is. And then processed foods, I have to admit, I do love potato chips. Every once in a while, I will buy a sharing size and I'll think, well, it's the better deal, right?
So how many servings a week? One, maybe? Two?
If you spread out the occasional potato chips, I don't even buy them every week, not by a long shot. Maybe once a month, maybe.
I'm still going to say that probably 10% or less, 5% of your salt comes from restaurant food and processed food, because you really don't buy those.
Yes, I try to avoid it consciously, right.
95% of your salt is coming from the salt shaker or the salt mill at home.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry, but if you don't let me use salt when I cook, I'm going to be grumpy.
Oh, for sure.
Really grumpy. Yes.
Absolutely.
So I need salt to cook. Any chef is going to tell you, you take salt away and it's a problem.
Well, in macrobiotics, we say we're how much percent water? I can't remember what the
like
number
70%,
is. 70% water. So if we're 70% water, we definitely need salt.
Yeah, and salt.
It's an ocean. It's salt water.
Exactly. And salt regulates the blood pressure. In fact, it maintains the blood pressure so that when you're lying down and you stand up, that you don't pass out.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a significant strain on your heart and your vasculature to make sure you still got blood to your brain. And when you lay down, you don't have gravity, right? Gravity is not, you're fine, because gravity is not working against you. But as soon as you're upright, now it's working against you. Understand, your heart is here. Your brain is here. We don't worry about getting blood to your liver or to your reproductive organs or to your big toe, right? Gravity's going to do it if you're standing upright.
Right.
But getting that blood flow to your brain, now we're working against gravity. That's a lot of work.
I never looked at standing up that way.
So we actually need to have blood pressure. So salt is used to maintain the blood pressure so it doesn't go too low, so we don't pass out. That's the other side of salt, right? Now, salt absolutely can increase the blood pressure too, but interesting enough, it doesn't have the same effect on all people. Some people are much more salt sensitive than other people, which means if you experiment with their salt, it's going to make a big difference in, I don't know, 20% of the population. I'm guessing on this number. Don't quote me on that. But it's a small percentage. They're salt sensitive.
Okay.
But the rest of the population is not salt sensitive. So wouldn't we want to tailor our message and say, wow, if you're salt sensitive, you really should probably look at sodium and try to decrease that. But the 80%, let's just say it's 80%, that doesn't have a problem, they get extra salt, It's no big deal.
No big deal.
What do? They pee it out, right? They just, their kidneys are functioning and they say, oh, too much sodium and I'm going to get rid of it. It's just like if you go out and eat and drink some alcohol and eat something salty and fatty, that kind of thing, what happens to your ring the next day?
It doesn't fit as well.
It doesn't fit very well. Because you're swollen. You have edema. I'm going to argue if we took your blood pressure, it's going to be higher.
Right.
But how long does this last? How long is it that you can't get the ring on or off?
A couple hours. A
couple hours and then boom, because you urinated out the extra salt and then you got rid of it. You balanced the blood, you balanced your vasculature, your blood volume, and your blood pressure comes back down.
It seems like there's an inordinate amount of high blood pressure in the United States, at least. I don't know about the world.
Well, yes. So understand that blood pressure is kind of a little, you know, we can't diagnose hypertension from one single reading. And blood pressure is not what I would say tightly regulated in the human body. What do I mean by that? It can go high or low. And why would it go high?
If you're under stress?
Yeah, if you're under stress. How many people in the United States are under stress?
How many aren't is probably a better question.
And I would hope that if you're under stress, if a bear is chasing you, that your blood pressure goes up. Like, that's a good thing. That's
right.
Saying, now I need to get more oxygen and I need to deliver glucose to my cells so that I can run, I can fight, I can do these things, I can think. So we want to mobilize that. That's not a bad thing. The question, of course, is, first of all, how long you're under stress. And then when you're not under stress, does the blood pressure come back down?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there's going to be variation. I don't know if you've ever done that. I mean, my mom has hypertension, yes. So I, you know, she's got a blood pressure cuff, and I'm like, Mom, you got to take your blood pressure twice a day. And it's an automatic cuff, so she doesn't really have to think about it, and it stores the numbers in there, right? So she doesn't have to write it down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is modern technology.
Modern technology at
but
its finest,
she
yeah.
still has to do it.
Right.
And she doesn't do it. She doesn't put the cuff on. But because I'm looking for data points, right? Because blood pressure... I mean, if you're like, oh, well, you know, I see people, oh, I want to get off my blood pressure pill. I'm like, well, okay, well, you think I don't have something that I'm going to give you and that's going to replace your blood pressure pill so you can throw it in the garbage? Plus, don't go off your blood pressure pill right away and talk to your medical doctor. I don't manage the medications, but I know enough. You don't go off. Just don't throw them in the garbage. But maybe you work on other things, so maybe you don't need the blood pressure pill,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense. And how would somebody know that they don't need a blood pressure pill?
Well, you have to take those readings, right?
Well, you could take the readings, or what else may happen? What happens if you don't have enough salt?
You're fatigued and dizzy.
You stand up and you pass out.
Right.
So those people that need the salt to maintain their blood pressure, it's also the case that when somebody's blood pressure is too low, they're going to get the dizziness. They're going to get some of those things. And then they go in and they're like, wow, I'm dizzy. I'm dizzy all the time. Take the blood pressure. It's low. They're like, oh, wow, you're taking too much blood pressure medication. Let's decrease that. Like, that's great. That's what we want.
Right.
That somebody's mm-hmm. telling them you don't need to take this, instead of saying, oh, well, there's some natural remedy that's going to fix this. Natural remedies don't work the same as drugs do. I'm good or bad, it's not about good or bad. It's just that they work differently,
mm-hmm.
and that you can't expect one to replace the other. But regardless, so this is the idea with salt, right? So salt is not just a bad guy. It's a good guy, but yes, it can be out of proportion. And for some people, it's a problem to eat too much salt. Where other people, it's a problem that they don't do enough salt. So the people that get dizzy when they stand up all the time and they're following a really low sodium diet, I'm going to argue, hey, you need some salt.
Right.
I mean, I don't need you to do this, but don't be scared of it.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think anyone in the audience saw what you just did, but you
yeah.
you behaved in such a way that you were pouring the salt out of your food.
Pouring the salt out of the salt shaker.
And doesn't that describe any food stuff, that it's not a bad guy, that there is a purpose to it? I think the only exception would be, and it's not really a food stuff, but maybe smoking.
Yeah.
You know, but foodstuffs in general, they have their negatives and their positives, and if you are the right type of person to be able to handle it to smaller or greater degree, there, you know, I mean, I don't know, that was one thing about macrobiotics. George Osawa was famous for saying, if you can't smoke whiskey and I'm sorry, if you can't smoke cigarettes and drink, if you can't smoke whiskey, wow. If you can't smoke cigarettes and drink whiskey, you're not healthy. Now, his point was, because
yes.
I never knew anybody in macrobiotics to drink whiskey. I did know people who smoked. But his point was you should be able to do the things that are, that people are saying are just an inherent evil and be able to overcome them. Again, smoking is probably not a great example, but in macrobiotics we talk about nightshades having oxalic acid, which can affect the joints and create arthritis when imbibed over a long period of time. So I took this as gospel for the last 25 years and rarely touched a tomato or a potato, never an eggplant. I'm not a fan anyway. But at any rate, so recently when I changed my tack and started incorporating a lot more red meat and just thought more about moving outside just the simple boundaries of macrobiotics, sure enough, I've been eating, I would say, a lot of tomatoes right now. They happen to be in season. And I wake up every morning and I kind of go, oh, that's so funny. You know, for 20 years, I said, no, we don't eat tomatoes. I would pass on them again and again. And so you do. I think it's such an important lesson that food is not necessarily inherently evil. The question is, what's its use and who are you and how does it make you feel?
Of course, it's always an N of one, right? Not an N of 350 million.
No matter what they say about oxalic acid or sodium or fat or carbohydrates, who are you and how do you feel
exactly
when you take it?
And this is so important. But how do you learn that? And is a popular diet book even going to do that for you?
Maybe. I mean,
they kind of get you to start to pay attention to that. But just the idea is that, oh, well, tomatoes are bad. And I will tell you, that's true. I think that tomatoes and nightshades are a trigger for inflammation. So if you come to me and you have inflammation and you have rheumatoid arthritis, I may say, hey, let's take out the nightshades for a month and see if it makes a difference. Maybe you're one of those type that really responds negatively to oxalic acid and to the nightshades, that we need to now pay attention to that. Right. Versus you're one of the people that doesn't have that. But there's certainly some value in it, but we make global statements. Yes,
right.
We just say bad food, good food, instead of saying, oh yeah, but what's the context? And macrobiotic is very wise that way, because they're getting you to be more in tune with seasons and things. I'm going to say too, but we also have our individual biochemistry. That your biochemistry, we have the same biochemistry, but we don't necessarily run it the same, right? I mean, you read a biochemistry textbook and it's going to label things and we're going to learn about the Krebs cycle, we're going to learn all these enzymes, and it's absolutely true to a certain extent, but not everybody runs it at the same speed or the same efficiency,
right?
So there's
reasons of gender, occupation, background, right?
Everything.
All of those things.
All sorts of variables will influence that.
Right.
So we kind of still glom it all together and say, well, this is how it is. This is how carbohydrates are metabolized. This is how fat is metabolized. Well, that's true, but some people may be better at it. Some people may not be so good at it. And then that's about trying to figure out what works for you. And again, it may be, do I eat meat? Do I eat plants? Like, which one makes me feel better? And is it, there's different energetic qualities to eating those foods. They're going to have a different effect on my biochemistry. So perhaps it's even my individual biochemistry that I'm constantly trying to figure out what is the right balance or not.
And constant is really the key word, because then you think about puberty versus perimenopause versus menopause versus old age versus, you know, infants and toddlers. And I mean, it just seems like you can coast for a while. And then when your situation changes, even biologically like that, you've got to reassess again.
Yes.
You know, what works and what doesn't.
So I've seen some professional athletes, retired professional athletes generally is what I've seen. And you could tell me about retired professional athletes. What do you think you could tell me about them?
When you said that, the first thing that came into my mind was, if they still want to behave as if they are expected to be at peak performance all the time, they're probably doing a whole heck of a lot of stuff that they don't need to, right?
Exactly.
I mean, the protein shakes and the glucose water. The people do all kinds of weird things that work for them when they're on the court, you know, extensively for hours playing, you know, match after match or seriously prepping for the big game. But I can imagine once you've retired, it's like, you can eat a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and just chill, man. It's cool.
That's right. And they don't do that. They continue to have behavior that was served them fine, or maybe they out-exercise their diet, or I don't know, right? But I can tell you, I start to see weight gain, I start to see pre-diabetes, I start to see all these things happen because they're not training any longer.
Right, they're not working it off, so to speak, or transforming it into muscle.
Correct, so they don't have that impetus that maybe protects them, per se? I don't know, but now it's about, well, do you want to start training again, or do we need to, like, look at your diet?
Mm-hmm.
And again, I mean, people, when they're 20, they eat whatever they want, and they still continue to try to eat that way as long as they can.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, yes. Every time we have these conversations, I think, oh, you have to be so awake and so aware, and life is so busy and can be very stressful. And so I just want to give a shout out to anyone who's listening and rolling their eyes and taking a big sigh right now saying, man, I hear what you're saying, but it sounds like so much awareness and so much work. I mean, it's a beautiful thing to tailor your whole life, your especially your diet, to where you're at in your life. But it just sometimes for me, it's as a single mom going to college and homeschooling my daughter next year, the thought that, I mean, gosh, if I had any sort of issue whatsoever and I had to go to regular appointments or think about I can't eat this and I shouldn't eat that and I, you know, no more fried food for a while and this and that and the other thing. It can be a part-time job sometimes.
A full-time job. Yes.
Right,
what's one
right.
of the diet books that I have there? You have to quit your job or one of you have to quit your job?
Right.
Wait, what's that? Yeah, one of you is going to have to quit your job diet.
In other words, one person who buys this book is going to realize that it's so much work to be healthy that you're going to have to quit your job.
Correct. But if we go back in time, what did we see? We saw a considerable amount of our resources spent, our energy spent on finding food, gathering food, cooking food, okay. Like it was all food.
Not even that far back. Think about the Strega Nonna in Italy going to the daily market with her basket and saying, what's fresh? What's here? Because this is what I'm going to make for what? For dinner. I mean, I don't know. Did she even have Pyrex? Did she throw anything in the fridge for tomorrow? I don't know. But I mean, it sounds so beautiful when you put it into practice.
We could do that here. We could just say, okay, we'll just shop at the co-op. And I don't know what I'm going to eat tomorrow. I'm going to go in there and I'm going to just buy what I need for tomorrow. First of all, there'll be no waste.
That's true.
I mean, I've had issues with, you know, this is my CSA story, right, where I get the zucchinis. Mm. Didn't we talk about this?
Yes.
How many zucchinis I had to throw away.
It's so
and
relatable.
I can't throw away food, right?
I know.
That's really difficult. I'll let it, like, rot until it's, like, a different color and it doesn't look like a zucchini, and then then I'll throw it away.
I made a triple batch of zucchini bread last month. I'm serious. And then I had to put it in my mother's freezer, some of it, because I had too much. Yes, totally relatable.
But we wouldn't go and buy 10 zucchini.
Right.
We would buy what we need for tomorrow.
3 potatoes is
exactly. Plenty
to make some mashed potatoes for 2.
Exactly. Yeah. Isn't that more kind of in tune? And I just get what I need right now. I'm not getting what I need tomorrow and next
I
week.
I hearken back to macrobiotics that talks about how you should really cook for your mood. If you're tired, right? You want
yes. Something
that's going to give you a little kick.
Yes.
If you're overworked, you want something that's going to relax you, like root vegetables or squash. And then on top of that, the weather, right? Who wants a warm cup of soup today on an 85-degree day? Save it for the rainy day, even in the summertime, right? You want maybe a cup of soup on a rainy summer day. And so you can imagine how in tune you would be to shop every day and say, well, I can see storm clouds. I'm going to make my favorite chocolate cake. Whereas if it's, you know, 100 degrees in the shade, you're not going to turn on your oven.
And how many recipes do you think you need? Or how many, let's say, meal plans? How many meal plans?
I'm a terrible person to ask. You know how many times I've sat down and spent hours revamping my idea of a meal plan? It is like an OCD reaction.
I'm asking an accountant.
Yes, it's so bad. You need a lot. No.
Do you need a lot?
No.
I think about like 10.
Right.
10, like if it's too few, maybe there's not enough variety, but maybe that's not a bad thing. I mean, if we went back in time, there may not be so much variety.
And most recently when I was revamping my menu list, because my daughter will tell you I do this, it's a disease. It is my disease. But most recently, I came up with the idea that I'm going to do it seasonally as well. I'm going to have 10 that I rotate in the fall with the seasonal food that's available. I know what's available in this area, right? And the 10 seasonal rotations of summer and the 10, you know, that was most recently what I did, because I thought, oh, you know, I've made meal plans before, and then the thing is not available in the grocery store, right? You're not going to make pesto in winter. I mean, you can buy it, but it's coming from
somewhere else.
California. Yes.
Yes. So you're far ahead of me.
but I can't, then I can't stick to it. Life gets very busy, you know.
So it's kind of like, you know, what are your pattern? What are the things that you're good at too, right? Things that you cook that you're competent at versus things that you cook that you're not competent at, right? I think of myself, how I learned to cook salmon. How much salmon have I screwed up in my life because I overcook it?
Overcooked, yeah.
Because I'm consistent, like, oh, I'm now going to undercook. Oh my gosh, it's not done yet. It's rare on the inside. But I've realized, yeah, that's okay. And actually, that's good that way.
Yeah.
But I had to screw it up. Yes? Like, somebody can tell me, I can read it, but it's not the same experience as me actually doing that and say, oh, I'm just going to cook it a little longer. It just needs a little bit more. Boom, done.
Right. And altitude and temperature and what kind of oven do you have? I mean, it's,
right.
You know, there's lots of variables in that
sense
as well.
And then you learn your oven.
Right.
You don't even pay attention to the temperature. You're like, oh, that temperature's sort of, but I know that it's like 3
says medium,
down
but
here.
It's 4 for me.
It's 4 for me. And, oh, I'm going to turn it down. Or, you know, you learn that. And that's, you know, it's like a, it's an art.
It's an art. Oh, I knew you were going to say that. Yes, it is absolutely an art. To cook a good meal for family and friends is a masterpiece.
And you get to consume it, right? So think of the artwork that's on the wall. I guess you consume it by looking at it, but it doesn't have that same, I mean, this is like a visceral effect, yes?
The literally.
Visceral effect, yeah. Mm-hmm. That my energy tomorrow or the rest of today is going to be based on the art that you created.
Right, yes.
Isn't that beautiful?
Going back to macrobiotics, I can't help it, but in macrobiotics they say you're creating your destiny. You're
absolutely.
Creating your destiny every day, 3 times a day, and this is why it's paramount to make your own choices and not eat out, or eat out as infrequently or buy as little packaged food as you can get away with, because you are the one who is authoring your life.
Yes.
By creating and consuming what you chose according to your everything, who you are, where you are, when you are, why you are, and what you want to do if you're a sports star. You want to create your destiny in that way. If you're a retired sports star, hang back, yo. You can relax a little bit.
So much wisdom. And I think about it, and I think, well, macrobiotic is eating a little bit of fish, and it's vegan, mostly vegan. I mean, that's the idea, but it's just a lifestyle. But
so much
maybe
more
it's the Wisconsin macrobiotic diet. Yes, that would have different things. And then it's not so much, oh, meat is a bad guy, but perhaps you're living in Japan. It's a different scenario. You
right.
have different food available to you. I mean, how much dairy do they consume in Japan? Not
very
much.
Little. Very, very little.
Because their resources on the island are not, you know, they harvest fish. They grow rice.
Right. Umeboshi plum, they pickle.
Yes.
Their thing about dairy is no animal drinks milk after it's weaned. And so there are powerful components within milk of any kind, and they're meant for the animal of the, you know, they're meant for the child of the animal that's consuming it. And of course, it's also meant at a time when they're supposed to be growing exponentially. And so it's generally avoided, but it's called a fun food, right?
Yeah, fun food. So, but again, perhaps it's from the perspective that they didn't have much of that. So if... Is it George O'Hara?
Osawa.
Mm-hmm. If he was in Chicago and he wrote that book and that's what his experience was, would it still be the same thing?
Yes, because you're talking about the spiritual, you know, I mean, or not even the spiritual, the scientific, what's the word I want, makeup of milk as well is meant to build bulk. It's meant to grow a young whatever it is.
So do you think there's humans that are better able to utilize that versus humans that aren't better able to utilize it? It may be based on the individual. I would
True.
Say lactose intolerance, correct?
Right.
So lots of people are lactose intolerant. Some people have
and
developed...
And macrobiotics points to that as almost a, see, listen to what I'm saying. I mean, the challenging question would be, okay, humans can overcome the bulky, you know, growing aspect of milk, but do they need to? Like, what's the, you know,
But if you need to, and you live in the Midwest and it's winter, and what do you have available to you? A cow is a very valuable asset.
True.
Because now you don't have to kill the cow. You have byproducts that you can live off of.
And the calcium that you could grow from the greens in your summer garden are no longer available.
Exactly.
That's a good point.
Right.
That's
so again, it's geographic. So it's geographical. But then, you know, it's just becomes that we use the science or we use things to validate. And I'm not saying this in a bad way.
No, I do the same thing. Yeah.
But the idea is it's going to be completely different from somebody else's experience that lives in a completely different area of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And understand, we're omnivores. Our digestive system, our metabolism is designed to deal with both plants and animals. We're not exclusive. Koala bears eat what?
Eucalyptus?
Eucalyptus.
Uh-huh.
No eucalyptus,
panda bears,
no koala.
Yeah, panda bears eat the shoots of bamboo.
Bamboo. So they have a very narrow, and they're going to be very susceptible to something happens. Humans.
Our dentition even tells us, right? We have grinding, we have tearing,
exactly.
We have ripping. I mean, we have it all.
Exactly. And we have the ability to ferment some in our digestive tract. We also have the ability to pass it through quickly, right? A lion has a very short digestive tract.
Right.
An orangutan has a very long digestive tract. So they're fermenting all the vegetable products that they're eating, all the plants, to get every last part of that. A lion doesn't eat that because a lion's got really rapid transit and they're going to have strong stomach acid to just, you know, be able to deal with meat.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how, and we're kind of in between.
Yeah, or we're everything.
And perhaps
right? mm-hmm.
some people do better because they have a longer digestive tract. I don't know if it's longer, but, you know, they're more in tune to eating more plants versus eating more animals. And interesting, when you eat more plants, your stomach acid will actually decrease.
Oh.
We've seen this. You'll adapt to that.
Right.
So you adapt to that.
And so here we have, again, the human, the ultimately adaptable human being.
Yes.
I mean, stick them in a jail, stick them in a desert, stick them in a frozen tundra, and they will be able to come out, you know, feeding themselves. As they come out on top, that sounds very American. We'll win. But they'll be able to survive.
Yeah, we're like
ultimately.
Cockroaches.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. That's a terrible way to end this.
Oh, gosh. Yes, but again, that adaptability. The problem is, have we been able to adapt to overnutrition? Have we been able to adapt to trans fats? Have we been able to adapt to excess sugar? Again, excess isn't
being defined. Convenience foods, snacking all night.
To the burger that'll sit out for 10 years and look exactly the same, right? How have we adapted to that? And maybe we'll develop the McDonald's gene and we'll be able to, you know, withstand that. But we have an onslaught now because of our nutrition transition. Yes, because we have we have lots of choice and we have lots of money. We are affluent enough to be able to choose things and not but just be like, oh, well, I can only choose rice and beans because that's all
this
I can afford.
Yeah, this is what's available. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So any final thoughts? We have a couple of minutes left of the program.
Boy, we still never did get to those diets that I followed,
We still did not.
If we were promising to that anybody, I failed miserably.
Again,
I will
point out.
Oh, no.
Paul Rattay, will you promise to talk about it next month?
I promise.
Okay. We have to begin with it, and you have to, because we did begin with it, but then we trailed off onto another topic.
But the macrobiotic diet is so interesting, right? So this is very important. And I wasn't ever macrobiotic. I was vegan for a while, but not macrobiotic.
Which, again, is not, you know, even though a lot of people associate
yes.
it, it's really not macrobiotic to be vegan exclusively. So thank you again sincerely for listening to our little radio show. Christina DeRocher and Paul Rattay, the skeptical naturopath, signing off on WDRT Community Radio.